as we watch the news about the war in Gaza and the Houthis' attacks on the Red Sea shipping lanes, one country that is writ large in the background is the Islamic Republic of Iran. So with the Iranian New Year coming up on Tuesday, March 19 at 8:06 p.m. Pacific Time, it's a good time to look at the history behind Iran. But wait, is it the Iranian New Year or the Persian New Year?
Oh, see, there I would say don't call it the Persian New Year. Very good question.
I could even ask this, if I may just ask another one. Mahsa Amini was Kurdish Iranian. So was she Persian or was she Iranian?
I am Darius, a Persian. Right. So he describes this as an ethnonym more than as an actual place. But then the area that these Persians live in, or Persians control often, then gets to be called Persia by extension from Persian. But the original name is actually it's an ethnonym. It's referring to the people, not a geography.
So is the term Iran broader than the term Persia?
Hellenism is not a foreign element in Iranian history. It becomes a foreign element because of, again, 19th century Europeans defining Greeks as their ancestors and owning.
Or am I reading too much into this, Dr. Razakhani?
No, you're not. You are putting your finger rather on a very, very thorny issue. Persian Achaemenids, Parthian Arsacids, and Persians, Sasanians, are these grand pre-Islamic dynasties of Iran. So the second Persian Empire is Persian as opposed to the Parthians, not Persian as opposed to Iranians, and that the rest weren't Iranians, other than the fact that the biggest part of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, is really written under the Sasanian control in Mesopotamia. The original cross that is taken by Khosrow from Jerusalem is returned.
The Holy Cross.
Or if you are a Muslim, you know, these systems are so corrupt and have so much pissed off their own people that people welcome Islam with open arms. Neither of these are true. Nobody welcomed Islam with their open arms. And Muslims didn't really force. How many people could be in Arabia that could force the entire population of the centers of civilization at that time of the at that time? And what really happens is that they don't lose the war, they lose their emperor, they lose Khosrow II. But Sasanians are inevitable. As I said, I think most of what we recognize as Iranian, which the Pahlavis were then trying to promote, is actually rooted in the Sasanian period.
Did you know that after Iran fell under Muslim Arab rule, for about two generations, the Sasanian royal family, with help from Imperial China, attempted to retake Iran from the Arabs? Today, you can travel to China and visit the tomb of the heir to the Sasanian throne, the last king of kings of the last Persian Empire before Islam. He was treated with honor in China and was buried in the mausoleum of the Tang Chinese Emperor. Hey there, News Peelers. Today is March 15, 2024. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it.
We hear a lot about Yemen these days,
including about how Iran is helping the Houthis. But that relationship, as narrated in our news media, is incomplete at best. First, as explained by my guest, Dr. Charles Schmitz, in my Unraveling the Middle East podcast, the Houthis and Iran are not tied together through some Shia alliance. It's really about geopolitics more than it is about religion. In fact, Yemen's Zaydi Shiaism is different than Iran's Twelver Shiaism in fundamental ways. So much so that Zaydi Shiites of Iran were forcibly converted to Iran's brand of Shiaism in the 16th century. Second, the Houthis are not a ragtag army, as they're often portrayed in our media. Quite the contrary, the Houthis and the tribe and the sect they belong to are quite sophisticated in combat and military strategy, and they have successfully defeated prior invasions by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, actually twice by Saudi Arabia, and were also significant military obstacles to the British, the Ottoman, and the Portuguese empires. You can learn more about Yemen and the Houthis in my two-part conversation with Dr. Schmitz, the link for which I've provided in the detailed caption of this episode. But one empire that Dr. Schmitz and I did not talk about was the Sasanian Persian Empire, in which Yemen was a province for more than half a century until the rise of Islam. In its last decade, the Sasanian Persians, before their ultimate fall in 651 to the Arab Muslims, the Sasanian Persians not only controlled Yemen, but much of the Arabian Peninsula's coast, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, much of Egypt, all of Palestine and Lebanon, a large chunk of Anatolia, and the Caucasus, which includes Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Armenia. But here is an interesting point about the Sasanian Persian Empire. While we refer to them as a Persian Empire, I personally used to refer to them as the Second Persian Empire for reasons that you'll find out in this episode, the empire was officially known as the Empire of Iranians. In fact, in inscriptions of his victories over the Romans, the second Sasanian King of Kings, Shapur I, says this, quote, "I am the Lord of the Empire of Iranians," end quote. So, when speaking in historical terms, when should we use the term Iran, and when should we use the term Persia? And are the people of Iran, today's Iran, Iranian, or are they Persian? To better understand Iran and Persia, and learn what happened to the Sasanian Empire, I spoke with Dr. Khodadad Rezakhani, who is a lecturer and a senior research fellow at Leiden University. He is a historian of global late antiquity and early Middle Ages, with a focus on Central and West Asia from 500 to 700 CE. His research focuses on the Sasanian and early Islamic economy of the Near East. This episode was recorded in 2023, which is important to note because we do talk about the Iranian calendar and some dates and events. To learn more about Dr. Rezakhani and his extensive research, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. On his homepage, you'll find tons of articles and several books about the fascinating history of Sasanians and much more about that period of history in the Middle East. So stay with me as Dr. Rezakhani and I peel the history behind this news. You can put a face to these podcasts by visiting our YouTube channels, youtube.com/@historybehindnews, and also youtube.com/@unravelingthemiddleeast. I've also dropped links to these YouTube channels below. Now, let's get back to peeling the history behind our news.
Dr. Rezakhani, it is a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. Let's start our conversation with some fundamentals here because I think they're very important to our audience. We often hear the terms Persian and Iranian used interchangeably. So are they interchangeable?
Well, in some senses, yes, and in some senses, no. Mm-hmm. Generally, Persian would refer to something that you would put under the umbrella of Iranian, but from a certain, let's say, modern point of view. Historically, though, the two terms have been used as a sort of equivalent for each other, but as exonyms and endonyms. So you would see, for example, all Greco-Roman sources refer to the people of this area as Persians, you know, the various versions of the word in Greek and Latin. In Arabic sources, the word Furs as the plural of Fars is mm-hmm. used. And in Chinese sources, the word Pusul, which is coming from Persian again, is used to refer to this to the people. But then internally, the word that is used as a collective is often something that comes from a root of Aer, the ancient Indo-Iranian or Indo-Iranian word of Aer, and its derivatives, of which Iran is a plural, really. So Iran is Iran, it's from Middle Persian, Iran, which means the Aer people, the Aers, really. So internally, we don't have the use of the word, any derivative of the word Persian or Pars, really, as a marker of the entirety. It is used in an external sense, and it is quite widespread. I give you a quick example of it. There is a section in Ibn Nadim, the early, early Islamic 10th century Islamic bibliographer, in which he's talking about various languages of what he calls the people of Furs, meaning everything. And he mentions the language of Pahlav and the language of Dari. And then under that Furs, he again says Furs. And here he specifies that he means the language or the dialect of the province of Fars to the south of Iran, and so on and so forth. So this Persian externally does have a use as a collective. It is a bit comparable, let's say, to the way Germans use the word Deutsch in German to describe themselves. But externally, obviously, the words derived from certain tribes of Germans, which is Germanii or Almanii in French and a lot of other languages, is used for that. So it's a matter of exonyms and endonyms.
So since you use Germany as an example, Dr. Razakhani, would the term Persia be comparable to Prussia in Germany, as in a certain ethnicity or people within a specific geography?
Yes, in a sense. Except nobody called Germans Prussians. But that's why you.
They don't anymore, Germany. But they did a century and a half ago, right? The Prussian Empire.
But that was a specific part of Germany. See, as a collective, you have the word German from Germani, from a tribe of ancient Germans who were in touch with the Romans, or you have the word Aleman. The French word used Alman, which comes from the Alemanni, which are the southwestern tribe of the Germans that the French bordered. So probably a better example is the Greek word for Greece, which is, comes from the root of Elas and Elenoi, Eleni, which mm-hmm. means Greeks in Greek. That's where the word Hellenistic comes from. But of course, externally, Greece is used in the West for Magna Graecia. And in the East, we use words derived from Ionia. So Yunan, these words which come from Ionia. So it's a matter of external and internal. Specifically speaking, Persia is a section in the south of Iran, and Persian is one of the Iranian languages, which we can then talk about.
So did the term Persia stuck after the first Persian Empire that was founded by Cyrus the Great? Is that how that happened? Because he was of Persian tribe?
Him being of a Persian tribe, yes, generally. The thing is, they are referred to as the kings of the Persians.
Yeah.
In Greek sources.
Yeah.
They are not necessarily referred to as the king of Persia. They're referred to as the king of the Persians. And they themselves, so for example, Darius says, I am Darius, a Persian, right? So he describes this as an ethnonym more than as an actual place. But then the area that these Persians live in, or Persians control often, then gets to be called Persia by extension from Persian. But the original name is actually, it's an ethnonym. It's referring to the people, yeah, not a geography.
So is the term Iran broader than the term Persia?
The term Iran, in a sense, is broader. Yes, in a sense, is describing a broader geography. But then, you know, things always get thorny, because then we have this other terminology that we are really now in the rise, in we really are sort of in a period of its growth, is the Persianate world, which is what we are using for really the Timurid and post-Timurid Central and West Asia. And this Persianate world then includes the world of Mughal India, Safavid Iran, and Ottoman Turkey and Eastern Europe. So then, in a sense, you have the use of a Persia-derived word for a wider thing. But generally, we should really discuss this issue of the origins of the study of ancient Iran, and where we get to this idea of what is Iranian and the Iranian family of languages, and the problem that we are applying a lot of this knowledge that we have from modern scholarship to our historical understanding. As a historian, I try to avoid that. People 2,000 years ago weren't necessarily aware of the fact that Sogdian and Scythian are from the same family of languages as Persian is. They would understand that Persian and Parthian are mutually understandable. But, you know, people weren't philologists back then.
They didn't
know that these are the family of languages. But we do know this. And then we tend to apply these bigger terms taken from our modern knowledge back into history. So really the answer to the question is, factually, yes, Persia, Persian is a subset of Iran, Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But whether historically it was really so relevant, divided, relevant, people even cared about it that much, is a matter of debate.
Okay. I'm glad you gave the example of Scythians. I have read about this, and I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. So indulge me in this, please. I've read that Scythians, who at one point covered much of what is modern Ukraine now, were Iranian or Iranic. Is that correct?
In the sense that they spoke an Iranic language, an Iranian language, yes. In that sense. And their descendants still live in that area, and they still speak an Iranian language. So, yes.
But at that time, the Iranians that lived in the Iranian plateau had, going back to what you were saying, historical, they shared no relevance or kinship with those that live in all the way north of the Baltic Sea. I'm sorry, the Black Sea.
Black Sea. Not anything that they were probably aware of.
Yeah.
But one might have not been that strangers to them. But nobody would be sitting in, Pasargadae in Persia and claim that the king of the Sakas. And by the way, those are only one tribe of the Sakas who are in the northern Black Sea. You have to notice that Sakas are a lot more widespread than...
I've seen it on a map. Yeah, very widespread.
It doesn't mean... No, they didn't necessarily feel a kinship. It's, again, our modern derivation that we know.
I see.
They spoke an Iranian language.
Fast forwarding to modern times, let me ask it this way. My parents were born in Tabriz, Azerbaijan. They speak Azeri Turkish, and they're Iranian, well, Iranian American now. So is my background Persian or Iranian?
Very good question.
I could even ask this, if I may just ask another one. Mahsa Amini, who was murdered in September, was Kurdish. So was she Persian or was she Iranian?
See, we go back to the original question.
Yeah.
Depends on what you want to identify yourself as now, right? Again, let's bring the German question. Okay, mm-hmm. there is this issue. Up to 1925-6, the land is called, internationally, is called Persia, right?
1926.
Yes. So less than 100 years ago, if you stop somebody in the street and said, what is this thing? They would have called it, if they weren't from that land, they would have called it Persia, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it is like Germans. What happened in 1926, Reza Shah told the rest of the world, hey, we don't call this land Persia, we call it Iran. So you guys call it Iran as well. Right,
and Reza Shah was the founder of the last Iranian dynasty.
Monarchical dynasty. So
yes.
the Pahlavi dynasty, right? So he comes and says that you have to use our native term for the country, right? It would be a bit like Germans coming and saying, hey, you have to call our country Deutschland. You should stop using Allemand and Tedesco and German, all of these words that you other people
interesting
use, and call our country the way we call them, right?
Actually, Erdogan is doing that now. He's telling the world to call Turkey Turkey.
But that's actually a different, the reason I still like the German idea is because specifically speaking, Germans were a tribe of the Deutsch people. Right, the Deutsch people.
Oh, I see. Which is different than the Turkey example I gave. Yes, I follow.
Deutsch is this greater. You know, this is the same word as Teutons. You know, the Teutonic people.
Yes.
So, this Teutonic people included Germans. Right now, the question would be in that sense. Then, would somebody who is a Saxon? Well, you know, in Germany today, that difference doesn't exist. But imagine it exists. Imagine the idea of Saxons and the Mecklenburgers and the Thuringer and the Bavarians and all of these people actually existed. So would you call a Bavarian or a Saxon or a Thuringer a German, or are they Deutsch? Because they don't belong to the tribe of Germanii. They belong to the nation of Teutonic people. But
interesting.
If 100 years ago, the Kurds of Iran were called Persian Kurds. The Turkish speakers of Iran were called Persian Turks to distinguish them from Ottoman Turks, from Ottoman Kurds. Right, the Baluches are called Persian Baluch, and this sticks in a sense. Right now, I would say you are an Iranian Turk, you are an Iranian Azeri, to distinguish you from a Republic of Azerbaijan Azeri.
Of course,
And it becomes interesting for me because my own stepfather, not my biological father, but the person I grew up with and consider my father, his family were from Ganja in the Republic of Azerbaijan. They moved to Iran, and then he was actually born in Burujerd, which is in Lorestan, which is a very nicely mixed background in that sense. What, you know, in this, I would say his family, part of them, were actually Republic of Azerbaijan Azeri, but he was Iranian Azeri, right? Like this is how you would say. I would say you are an Iranian Azeri, but if somebody calls you Persian Azeri, now it is becoming more and more as if this, I have argued this before, I have written an article called Persocentrism and the Iranian National Identity. Of this
Persocentrism?
Persocentrism and the Iranian National Identity, it's online.
Okay.
It's the idea, but this seems to then suggest, now if you say Persian Kurd, is as if you are suggesting that there is this Persian overlordship, or at least being understood. My argument in that thing was there is no Persian ethnicity. Nobody calls themselves in Iran Persian, right? There are people who speak Persian and are from Isfahan. There's people who speak Persian and are from Tehran. There are people who speak Persian and are from Kerman. But nobody calls themselves Persian.
Like, that's true.
This is not what they say, right?
Yeah, Persian. Yeah.
So this idea of the there is no central majority. That's why I'm against the term minority, use of the word minority, because who is the majority? It's assuming that there is a majority.
Yeah.
There is no majority, right? Majority, and it becomes often linguistic. That's the problem, that we take language as the only marker of identity, and we ignore the fact that, well, after all, I, as a Tehrani, have a lot more to share with the Mazandaranis. In every sense of the word, right? In what I eat, in how I behave, in even the dialect I speak, and I have a lot to share with the Mazandaranis. Why am I necessarily connected to the Kermani, right? Yeah. Because we speak the same language? No, not the same.
You know, we could have a whole podcast of just talk about that, maybe more than one. You teach courses on this. We talked about Iran, Iranians and Persians. I would be committing podcasting malpractice if I didn't ask you about the Persian New Year that's just coming up in a few days. As a point of interest, first, what year is it? That itself is a point of contention sometimes. It brings up a lot of interesting stuff. And two, when did it start? The Persian New Year, the celebration.
Oh, see, there I would say don't call it the Persian New Year.
Okay, go ahead.
I would say the Iranian New Year.
Interesting.
Because there, if in the modern sense, we're considering Iran this wider terminology, that doesn't have to do with the country necessarily, but rather with the entire cultural extent. You know, the celebration is actually celebrated in many parts of the world outside the borders of Iran. And it certainly is not Persian in the sense of it has never been connected necessarily to the Persian rituals in the sense of the specific southern Persia. I mean, in the sense of Fars.
The province.
They're doing are very widespread. It's the year 1402, based on the Hijra calendar.
The Islamic calendar.
I don't have a problem with it, because in general, the way we counted years was based on the years of the rule of the kings, right? So before Islam, you don't really have a continuous calendar. You have the year 32 of Khosrow II. Right, that's how things are counted. A bit like the Chinese.
And then it would start again with the next monarch.
Exactly, and the last year of this monarch would be the first year of that monarch. The Chinese have the same thing. They have eras. So it's year three of the era of Gaozang of the Tang Empire. That's how they counted. This there was a calendar. There was an ancient calendar was used, but you would be surprised. It was the Seleucid calendar. It was a calendar that was established by the Seleucus I, the Diadochoi sort of ruler that replaced Alexander in Iran.
The Greek rulers.
They use that for certain type of timekeeping. But the regular daily calendar was based on the king's thing. There is another one based on a king's rule, and that's the Yazdgerdi calendar, which essentially is 10 years behind the Hijri, the solar Hijri calendar. So in the Yazdgerdi calendar, it would be 1392 now. But I'm just okay with the Iranian calendar because it goes to the medieval period. It is a solar calendar. And well, okay, yeah, the beginning of it starts with the Hijra of Muhammad, which majority of Iranians are Muslim. So why not? I don't see a problem.
You mentioned solar. Why is it that the Iranian calendar is on a solar system? And when you look around that region, you know, to the east and west, most other calendars are based on a lunar system.
It's a really good question about why. Because the Chinese use lunar, the Jews use lunar, and the
Arabs.
The Arabs use lunar as well. I don't really know. In the ancient period, both were used simultaneously for different purposes. Solar calendar is obviously coming from Babylonia, ancient Babylonia. Okay. They used this. So the whole setting of the solar calendar is really an ancient Babylonian thing. And it was always used. I don't really have a very good reason. What we know as the Zoroastrian calendar, how ancient it is and when exactly it came up, they came up with it. I don't really have a very clear opinion on that, but that's also solar. But lunar was used simultaneously. So lunar calendar wasn't unknown. The way we have it now, which is happening really in the 11th, 12th century, is for the organization of agriculture and for tax purposes. It's because the biggest thing about the area that Iran and the area around it is the agriculture and the control of water and, you know, growing of things.
You mean when you say the way we have it now, you mean the solar system?
The solar system.
Yeah.
Okay. So the solar system is a lot more useful for agricultural activity. In at least in the 11th, 12th century, when they're setting it up, that's mostly the reason. But I really don't know why necessarily lunars didn't take on as much. For most of Iranian history, after Islam, it did. After all, until 1906, that's what we were using anyway. So we reintroduced it. But just solar calendar has a longer history within the Iranian world.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about a second Persian Empire, one that changed world history in a significant and lasting way. We'll be right back. Many years ago, when I was about to start law school, it occurred to me that I didn't know much about the history of Iran, the country of my birth. So I decided that I would start from the beginning, To do that, I purchased a 500-page-plus book titled The History of the Persian Empire, a seminal and remarkable book by the renowned professor Albert T. Olmsted of the University of Chicago. The book was completed by his colleagues after his death in 1945 and then published posthumously in 1948. I remember it was a cold Sunday in San Francisco, around 6 a.m. With coffee in hand, I opened the book and was immediately struck by its first line. I'll read it for you. Quote, "When Cyrus entered Babylon in 539 BC, the world was old." End quote. This opening and the explanation that followed made clear to me that at the time of Cyrus the Great, there was already ancient history in the Middle East. Damn, I said to myself, this isn't the beginning at all. It isn't the beginning of Iran's history. It isn't the beginning of Middle East history. And in a way, I kind of knew of this. I knew of the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Israelites, the Elamites, the Sumerians, Phoenicians, Babylonians, Assyrians, and so forth and on. But for some reason, these ancient civilizations, some of them even from Iran, were not in the forefront of my mind when I embarked on this journey to learn about Iran from the beginning. Frankly, I feel silly sharing this personal story with you. I should have known better, but that's okay, because I've made up for it since then and educated myself over the years. For example, I recently spoke with Dr. Amanda Padani about the history of the ancient Middle East, stories of kings, gods, scribes, weavers, soldiers, and their families told over 500,000 clay tablets, and the story of ancient Middle Easterners drinking beer from big bowls with their straws. This is an amazing story from a time long before the Persian Empire, a time before any empires at all, a golden period of peace in the Middle East, a peace that was predicated on sophisticated diplomacy, which was based on five essential elements. This is also a period long before monotheism, when Middle Easterners, quote, absolutely believed in one another's gods, end quote. In fact, back then, they had no word for religion. Imagine that, a peaceful Middle East without religious strife. I've dropped links to my two-part conversation with Dr. Padani in the detailed caption of this episode. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Reza Khani about Iranians, about Persians. Dr. Reza Khani, I'm going to dive into this segment by asking you this. What is Iran Shahr? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
So what is that term?
Well, Iran Shahr specifically is the term that late Sasanian and early Islamic sources talking about late Sasanian period in Middle Persian, in the language of the Sasanians, used to describe the empire. So, you know, it's made up of the word Iran, which is, as I said, is the plural of air. And Shahr here, which Persian speaker might recognize as the modern term for a city, but it really means a domain. It actually comes from the same root that the word Shah comes from. So it's the domain, it's the expanse. So it's expanse or the domain of the people of air. The term gets used in the late Sasanian and early Islamic period to describe the sort of the world of the Sasanian Empire. There is a lot of detail and there's a lot of discussion that we haven't settled yet about how this term was understood and how it was understood from, you know, transposing mythological geography and physical geography of the land, which requires a whole lot of explanation. But generally, that's it. We could, in a, for lack of a better term, we could say that Iran Shahr, at least in the late antique, early Islamic period, equals the Sasanian territories.
Was the reason that the term Iran Shahr was used in the Sasanian era versus prior empires such as the Achaemenid Persian Empire? What I'm trying to get at, let me just ask it this way. Did the concept of Iran, is that something that the Sasanian Empire was promoting or establishing versus the prior large Persian Empire, the Achaemenid Empire? Or is am I reading too much into this, Dr. Razakhani?
No, you're not. You are putting your finger rather on a very, very thorny issue. And this issue of terminology and labels, which we often take very for granted. Well, you have to notice, Iran Shahr is not even used during the Sasanian period that extensively, at least in the first centuries. You have to notice that the first rulers of this land, Sasanian rulers of this land, they are calling themselves Shahanshah-e-Iran and then Shahanshah-e-Iran-o-an-Iran. Yani it means the king of kings of the Iran, however you want to see that. You want to see that as a indicative of land or Iran in the sense of people of air, whatever that means, which we should get into when we get to Zoroastrianism. And what is not Iran, what is not Air, or what is not Iran. So early on the coins of Ardashir the First, Shapur the First is King of Kings of Iran. Then on the inscription of Shapur the First, and then on the coins of his son Hormuz the First, the word King of Kings of Iran and non-Iran is added. And then we start progressing, and then, you know, that falls out, and that's probably has something to do with the changing understanding of geography and the population. So again, I have certain ideas about it, and my ideas are my own. There is no necessarily grand agreement on this. So even the word Iran Shahr, you could say, is a mid to late Sasanian invention. And we really have it from the Pahlavi documents that occur in the early Islamic period, in a sense. So that is important. Why didn't the Achaemenids have something like this, or the Parthians, or Sassanids have this? I would imagine there's, again, not a good answer to this, but I think it has to do with an understanding of your own legitimacy within not only territorial and geographical boundaries, but within a sort of a cosmic understanding. And I would say the later Sasanians are slowly moving towards understanding their territory, the area that they actually rule, in physical terms, and trying to define it in physical terms, rather than thinking of it as a sort of a cosmic name, or a name that is setting out us versus them. So more a sort of
inclusive,
more inclusive and exclusive, more trying to define who is us and who is not us, in a sense.
Okay.
And then it becomes a territory. It really becomes a territory the way Sasanians recognize.
In the last segment, we talked about, I think we mentioned this, that Sasanians, the family, the royal family itself, was Persian, right?
Yeah.
So does that make Sasanians, and you and I touched on this during the break, Dr. Razakhani, does that make the Sasanians the second Persian Empire? The first being the one that was founded by Cyrus the Great and ultimately defeated by Alexander the Great?
Specifically, if you want to be nitty gritty and, you know, get to the actual exact point, yes, they both came from the province of Persia. They okay. came both from the province of Fars, from the province of Persis during the Arsacid and Seleucid period. So in that sense, yes, they are both coming from the same province. Whether they are sharing the same ethnicity, I would step back from defining that. This term Second Persian Empire for Sasanians is a largely 19th century British creation. That comes from this grand book that was written, or a series of books that was written about the ancient world. And the term Second Persian Empire came out largely in opposition to the Arsacid Empire, which was called the Parthian Empire, because the Arsacid family came from Parthia, which is in northeastern part of the land. So it is in the province, it is in modern province of Khorasan and on the borderland of Afghanistan, Turkmenistan.
So was the Parthian Empire an Iranian empire?
Yes, because in a sense, they have all the characteristics that we want to call an Iranian empire. They speak an Iranian language, if we go against the 19th century thing. They are an Iranian people. They were even accused, whether correctly or not, is a matter of Arsacid history is quite a problematic thing. They were even accused of being anti-Hellenistic, being the Iranians who are pushing out the Hellenes. So
I've read that. Yeah.
In this fight, which I disagree, by the way, I think Hellenism is not a foreign element in Iranian history. It becomes a foreign element because of, again, 19th century Europeans defining Greeks as their ancestors and owning. I always use this joke. My uncle actually is called Plato, Aflatun, and I went to school.
What a great name.
Yeah, and my best friend in school was called Aristotle. So you just find an English person whose uncle is called Plato and who went to school with Aristotle. The Greek culture is as much sort of part of this culture as it is. But again, in 19th century, Greece becomes the chosen ancestor of the European colonialized mindset, and then it becomes again. So Parthians, even in the 19th century history writing, become the great opponents of the Greeks. So yes, Parthians are certainly Iranian. So it's understood that Achaemenids, Persian Achaemenids, Parthian Arsacids, and Persians Sasanians are these grand pre-Islamic dynasties of Iran. So the Second Persian Empire is Persian as opposed to the Parthians, not Persian as opposed to Iranians, and that the rest weren't Iranians.
Parthians
are Iranian too.
That's a good way of drawing a contrast for me to understand. So we're talking about Sasanians in this segment. How important was this empire in its own time?
In its own time, very. In its own time, I would say of course, you are talking about 430 years of history. So, you know, it's very hard to define something that has lasted that long. Imagine we're talking about something that is lasting from almost Queen Elizabeth I to now. You know, this is a rather daunting sort of stretch of time. They are, however, quite important. At no point in their history, they lose their importance in Western Central Asia and get reduced to something insignificant. Of course, they fluctuate. Early on in the 3rd century, they have a growth burst, which takes them from really what is today Afghanistan all the way to what is today borders of today Syria, which becomes more or less their core territory. So that Iran Shah really starts defining slowly this territory from Afghanistan to the borders of Syria. They do in the late 5th century, they lose the eastern part of their territories to this new Central Asian power of the Heftalites. But that doesn't really last that long. They do sort of recover part of it in the 6th century. And then in the 7th century, under the rule of what I consider their greatest emperor, Khosrow II, they conquer all of Syria, Palestine, Anatolia, and Egypt. And they become the most important, really, power for a short period of time. And I don't think the period is really that short. because I think there is a continuity to it that we don't consider. But anyway, they are never an insignificant empire. They are economically quite important.
How so?
Well, they are both in production economy. Sasanians generally invested both the central empire through direct investment and also through various administrative and taxation reforms really encourages settlements, development of land, mining, introduction of new crops, which are cash crops often, and then there's a whole lot of trading, encouragement of trade. So we have that, for example, you know, the hinterland of Baghdad, as it's called by one of the archaeologists, the northern parts of Mesopotamia, the intensity of settlement in the late Sasanian period is not met until the modern times. So,
oh, wow.
In the 6th and 7th century, the upper part of Mesopotamia is the most intense settlement that it has had in its history until modern times. And for example, in the Indian Ocean trade, it seems that the, you know, Persian traders, whatever, the traders that are subject to the Sasanians, are controlling really all of the port trade on the western coast of India, and they are the ones who are the main conduits for transfer of goods that comes from East Asia to western part of the Indian Ocean. They're among the, they are the most important players in the system. So economically, socially, politically, and militarily, they are quite important.
How about their soft power? You know how the United States has soft power and China is trying to develop a soft power?
In imperial sense, that's really hard to say, you know, because in empires don't have clear boundaries the way we think of countries, right?
Yeah.
So having influence, having soft power influence is a hard thing to really say how far it expands. We know that this world has a continuous or lasting effect in many senses. Many of the things that we recognize in a, let's say this, many of the things that we recognize in the medieval and modern period as Iranian are really established in the Sasanian period, right? So anything from that Nowruz question that you asked and the traditions associated with it, I don't know, for me, I like coins. So for me, one of the most interesting things is that, you know, still in the Middle East, you have two sorts of main names for coins, for money. One of them is dinar, which comes from Latin denarius, and one of them is dirham, which comes from Sasanian money, dirham. Yes, originally comes from Greek drachma, which was the currency of Athens, and that's how it came. But it spreads because of the Sasanians. The word dirham spreads because of Sasanians. And really, the Sasanian coinage is the basis of Islamic silver coinage all through the Middle Ages. They recently found Sasanian coins in Britain, a couple of them near Manchester in Britain. They were Sasanian coins. So like this entire thing. So they are very influential in many senses of the word. Their soft power is lasting rather than contemporaneously. We could study how far and whether they actually had any plans. Yes, in some senses, you could say, for example, later Sasanian emperors seem to be very much trying to extend their soft power by supporting certain communities of Eastern Christians in Syria, to trying to buy, for example, the Eastern Syriac churches support against the Byzantines, right? How far that goes, I don't know. But is that really, can you really call that a soft power? Because it is within military sense.
Yeah.
We have several references to Jewish populations being naturally sort of, for various reasons, looking towards the Sasanian Empire. Other than the fact that the biggest part of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, is really written under the Sasanian control in Mesopotamia, you know, you have references to various Jewish characters who end up being pro-Sasanians. So, you know, but it's really hard to say what the soft power for an empire.
Yeah.
Because in a sense, an empire is all soft power.
An empire is all soft power. That's very interesting. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the fall of the Sasanian Empire and the rise of Islam.
I'm making a change to our program and would like to share with you. But don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. And this is only temporary. We're temporarily transitioning from a weekly to a bi-monthly program in Unraveling the Middle East podcast, as well as the History Behind News podcast. We're working to bring you more videos of our interviews, particularly on YouTube, which is a great platform for programs such as ours, education combined with entertainment. And as our program is growing, we need more resources. And to get it, I'm looking at grants and other potential funding that could help. We're also enhancing our program in several other ways that I won't bore you with here. Of course, researching and implementing all of this will take much of our time, my time. So I do need the extra week in between the podcast episodes. But again, this change will be temporary, and I can't wait to return to our weekly programming because that's what I really enjoy the most, the history, discussing it with scholars, and sharing it with you. As always, you're welcome to send me emails to info@historybehindnews.com.
Dr. Rezakhani, in the last decades of the Sasanian Empire, the empire launched a war against the Byzantine Empire. It was not their first war. The Byzantine Empire is the Eastern Roman Empire. Their war lasted 25 years. Two superpowers at the time, I think there were three superpowers. One was the Byzantine Empire, the Sasanian Empire, and the Tang Dynasty, the Chinese Empire. So two superpowers are at war for a quarter century. How devastating was this?
Devastating in a sense, a lot, but actually not much for Sasanians.
Sasanians, it wasn't.
Sasanians are coming out with pretty flying colors out of this thing. It is initially very disastrous for the Byzantines because they lose all of their eastern territories. So, you know, imagine, let's say the height of the war to 220. I mean, 620. In 620, the Byzantines are in control of Constantinople, Balkans, and what is now Greece, parts of southern Italy, and parts of northern Africa, and maybe a couple of cities on the Iberian Peninsula. They have lost Egypt, they have lost Palestine, they have lost Syria, and they have lost Anatolia.
Wow.
The Sasanians, for a good, say, 17, 18 years, I would say close to 20 years, are actually controlling all of this area. And it does take a lot of resources, obviously. Yeah. I'm actually right now in the process of completing a paper exactly about this war. And it has taken Sasanians 100 years of preparation. It has taken Sasanians 100 years of completely changing the face of their empire economically to be able to achieve this. But they do achieve it. And what really happens is that they don't lose the war. They lose their emperor. They lose Khosrow II. What happens is that Khosrow II becomes, you know, this...
Who's your favorite?
Who's my favorite? Okay. I think he's the only one who is thinking in a big strategic terms.
Okay.
He's removed because he's not popular anymore. And I think it also has something to do with Heraclius, the Byzantine emperor, actually finding other ways. Talk about soft power. He finds a soft power way of removing Khosrow from the throne. But on the other hand,
I thought his son killed him.
Well, the son doesn't kill him. Okay, the story is that he gets removed via a palace coup. So in 628, on the 9th of February of 628, he's actually removed from the throne via a palace coup. He's put under custody. Then there is a, what you can just call a court case raised against him. We have the terms of this court case. It's recorded in later histories.
Wow.
He answers this, defends himself. He defends himself point by point. Then there is a judgment that basically dismisses his points and condemns him to death. And he's actually killed by one of the courtiers, in fact, by a person who actually, you know, does the execution.
Dr. Reza Khan, I have to interrupt you here because I'm not following this story. I'm just going by what you said. You said for 17 to 18 years, the war is going well for the Sasanian Empire. And they've taken, based on what you're saying, almost like, I don't know, two-thirds of the Byzantine Empire. Yeah. So shouldn't Khosrow II be admired and loved by everyone? They call him Khosrow II the victor, I think. Khosrow Piruz, I think. Victorious, there you go. So why have a coup? He's kicking butt here.
Well, that's a good question. And if I could answer that, my paper would be finished. And a lot of people would actually have...
There you go. Maybe you present your paper right here. Yeah.
There is an entire thing. It's too much detail to go through. The simple answer is I don't know why they remove him. They just remove him. It's just that there is a coup against him. And the coup is somehow instigated by a rebellious general who seems to have had some sort of an encouragement or even support and promise from Heraclius, the Byzantine emperor, to do this. And then Khosrow's son, as you said, who is unhappy and who is the beneficiary of this thing, he does become emperor after the death of his dad.
But it's his son with his Roman wife, with his Armenian wife.
It's Roman wife. We don't really know. See, that story is not mentioned contemporaneously. Story of him being the son of a Roman wife is not
interesting.
I actually have an article about this. If anybody wants to read, it's in the British Journal History Today.
What I'm going to do, I'm actually going to get the link for that article from you and added into the detailed caption of this episode. Yeah. But now I'm all flummoxed because you're turning this story around on me. I thought I was going to offend you and say your favorite emperor, Khosrow II, was actually the megalomaniac who took the Iran Empire through 25 years of war. The Byzantine Empire sued for peace 2 or 3 times, I think, and he refused. And in so doing, drained the entire Iranian economy. By Iran, I mean the Empire of Iran. And that opened the way for Arabs to conquer Iran. And you're saying, you're shaking your head, and you're saying, no, that's wrong. Because this happens very quickly. Just, I don't know, about a decade or so after, or maybe less than that, the Sasanian-Byzantine war, colossal war, ends, the empire falls to the Arabs. I don't have the exact years in mind, but you're shaking your head in affirmation that sort of the sequence of events are. Okay. I'm trying to figure out how this happens. You go from an empire to losing to Arabs.
See, because you don't. This is the thing.
Because you don't? Is that what you said?
This is my research, and I told you I'm a revisionist. God, how do I say this in a short? It is something that, however I say it, unless I can actually spend hours explaining it reading it.
Oh boy,
I wouldn't be able to show you what it is. The issue is, we essentially see these things as separate events. We think of the war of Khosrow II with Byzantium, then the activities of Muhammad, the prophet of the Islam at the period, and the conquest period as different events. And we essentially think of Arabs as outsiders to both of these superpowers, as you call them, who then take advantage of the weaknesses of both empires and conquer.
That's right? My view. Yeah, that's what I share with you. Yeah. Okay.
So there is a saying, if something is too improbable to be, it probably is.
Yeah, that's my point. I mean, how does that happen? It's so improbable.
Yeah, because if the Muslims had come out of, you know, the way we imagine them, galloping on their horses and camels from outside Arabia, and had come and conquered two empires in ruins, they would have been in ruins themselves. So how would you then make sense of the fact that you almost immediately enter a period of economic, cultural, every sense expansion, that they are not receiving, they are not conquering cities that don't have economic abilities. They are not getting, all the tales that we get from the early Islamic conquest is each one of these cities are full of treasures. It's full of money. Money constantly comes to Arabs and they send it to Medina and they can't believe it. These cities, and then they enter these cities, and these cities are completely built up. We have them archaeologically, right? The level of occupation in late Sasanian, late Byzantine, early Islamic period is unprecedented. These are big, prosperous cities that fall into the hands of these Muslims. They are not cities ravaged and destroyed by war for a 25-year war.
So that's amazing. This is completely counter to what I suggested and what I have read. And to my credit, I'm not making that up. I've read this in different.
Of course, this is a narrative I mentioned at the beginning of my article and the book that I'm writing about this, that comes from, again, a modern concern that thinks of the result of things, not of the historical processes themselves. Right. In this, the beginning of Islam in these lands is seen as an external event coming to these lands. And, you know, you shouldn't be able to conquer empires because we are equating empires with countries. So this is a Persian land and that is the Roman land that falls to these foreign Arabs. Right. Muslims who then force everybody to convert to Islam.
Yeah. That's the story, right?
Or if you are a Muslim, you know, these systems are so corrupt and have so much pissed off their own people that people welcome Islam with open arms. Neither of these are true. Nobody welcomed Islam with their open arms. And Muslims didn't really force. How many people could be in Arabia that could force the entire population of the centers of civilization at that time of the at that time? Syria, Mesopotamia, these are extremely complicated, sophisticated societies with high population, highly educated, highly urbanized populations in that region. How could these people come from outside and they just conquer them if they're completely unknown and outsiders? How much war could be? And if the war was that devastating, that was destroying these cities, that these cities could be taken by a couple of people from the middle of the desert, then how did they arrive there and it was all fine?
How did they run the administration and bureaucracy if it was devastated, right? That's the point you're making.
The first thing that Omar does when he enters this area...
Omar being the head of the Muslim forces.
Being the second Muslim caliph and the guy under whom most of the futuhat, most of the conquests are supposed to have happened. The first thing it does is to establish a diwan to manage all the money that is coming in. And when you read early on, there's all the money that is coming in. This money is there. Nobody is saying that the Sasanian treasury is dilapidated because of the wars. These things don't exist in actual evidence. These are all... So the narrative that we often have,
Who came up with this narrative then?
Abdul Hussein Zarrinkoub and people like him.
I don't know who that gentleman is.
see, there you go. I had a conversation with one of the a BBC journalist who does a once a year sort of a Nowruz podcast, who's a friend of mine, about the book of this gentleman, Abdul Hussein Zarrinkoub, one of the most influential historians of Iran in the past 100 days. It's not obviously he didn't create it. It comes out of this entire last 150 years of study of ancient Iran. So that's a totally different podcast that I'm totally willing to go through with you. Mm-hmm. But it's a narrative of decline. The only way these things could have happened is because there was a decline. right? We still have books written in the last 10 years who try to make sense of the decline. The problem is when you go there, there is no decline. You don't actually see the decline. You're supposed to have ruined cities, dilapidated.
Yeah, I've actually read about those ruined cities.
Yeah, but which ruined cities? Like, they are not there. They are, if you go and actually dig, there are no ruined cities. They're fine. You know, Ctesiphon is ruined, the capital. But 100, 200 years later, in the process of building up Baghdad, Ctesiphon is abandoned in the early Islamic period for various reasons. And then the material from Ctesiphon gets used to building of Baghdad. Nobody goes and destroys these things, right? It's not really, they are not ruined. Nobody, Romans never... See, Heraclius never comes and conquers his territories back or conquers anything of the Sasanians. There is a war up in near Nineveh. There he defeats a Sasanian contingent, hears of the coup against Khosrow II, and then goes back to Constantinople. And then there are a series of negotiations with Khosrow's son Shiroye and Khosrow's grandson Ardashir III, and then Khosrow's daughter Huram, during which cities are returned or sometimes not returned. The original cross that is taken by Khosrow from Jerusalem is returned.
The Holy Cross.
We reach a period, a state of sort of balance between the two empires, before, you know, the Islamic Empire rises and takes over this territory. But there is no proper, you know, destruction. The thing with this, it's just not there. It's just there is.
This is fascinating. This is so. First of all, I appreciate it, but this is so counter to all the history that I have read or watched. And I'm just going to make an executive decision right now. Not to ask any more questions on this, because we'll be talking about this fascinating topic for another.
To be quite honest, I put an hour and a half of time. So
no, I could too. So I love it.
20 minutes more. You know what the answer is?
What's the answer?
Arabs are not in the middle of the desert. Local people of southern Mesopotamia and southern Syria are Arabs too. They are Christian Arab tribes and city-dwelling population between the Sasanians and the Byzantines. Byzantines and Sasanians...
Are you talking about the two buffer states?
Buffer states and everything in between. Okay. And these people are the people who are actually fighting for the Sasanians, right? So when the Sasanian emperor dies, they become autocephalous. And they start conquering these areas on their own behalf then. The areas that they have conquered on behalf of the Sasanians, they just start possessing them. Now they need an authority. The Sasanians are gone. The Byzantines are absolutely destroyed. Who do they go to? The nascent empire, the nascent kingdom in Medina, who also speaks Arabic. So what is? The conquests have already happened. There are no conquests. Qadisiyah, the biggest thing of between Sasanians and Muslims, it probably is something like, even based on numbers that the books give, is about 250 Muslim troops versus 500 Sasanian troops. It's a small battle. The issue is all of these Muslim sources are written 300 years later. So they are reflecting on these grand events because these are histories of salvation. Because they are trying to describe the glory of the past, which
kind of like how the Greeks did about the Persian, right? These are politically motivated historiography. Okay.
Arabs are not from the desert. We think of Arabs from the desert. There are Arabs in the desert as well, but the vast majority of Arabs are just living there. They're there. They are from there. Hira is an Arab kingdom. Palestine has two Arabic kingdoms. They're there. They're not coming from anywhere else. They're part of these empires. So they see the empires falling apart. They're like, okay, fine. Your emperor is dead and your emperor is back in Constantinople and cannot make it further south in Edessa. Fine.
So your paper that you're working on right now details all of this.
One aspect of it. I have written 5 papers so far about this.
Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Reza Khani as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Reza Khani, After the fall of the Sasanian Empire, did the Sasanian royal family escape to China, to the Tang Dynasty? And I ask this question because I've read several different accounts, almost romantic, sentimentally like accounts of how the heirs to the throne, if you will, for two or perhaps three generations were still trying to reconquer the Sasanian Empire. And I've seen this online. There's actually tombs of Sasanian royal family in China today.
Yeah.
So is there a story here? Is that
Well, there's a story there, but in simple terms, yes. After the death of the last official Sasanian emperor, Yazgir III, it seems that his two sons, particularly his elder son, Peroz, initially in Sistan in East Iran, and then later in northern Afghanistan, the area around Balkh today, rule under a Chinese protectorate. It's called actually the Chinese Protectorate of the West. They rule under a Chinese Tang protectorate for anywhere between 10 to 15 years. In 673, Peroz shows up in Chang'an, the capital of the Tang, where he seems to become a very honored guest of the Tang Emperor, given Chinese titles, is given the right to build a temple, although we don't know what religion temple he's building, and then dies in 679. He's buried in the mausoleum of the Emperor Gaozang of the Tang in Chang'an. Today is actually a museum. You could go see it. Oh, there wow. are his name is included on an inscription in a pedestal, and there is a statue, a headless statue, that is sort of based on some conjecture, but also some writing, is probably him. This seems to be also the time that his son Narseh, who is in Chinese sources called Neshe, is similarly taken by a Chinese general to the West, and they again try to install him on a Western throne. How much they actually had successful campaigns against the new power of the Islamic Caliphate and tried to conquer, we have no evidence of. We know that they ruled in this area under the Chinese auspices and suzerainty. And of course, the Chinese are in that region until 750, when they lose the famous battle of Talas to the Caliphate. Yeah. And, you know, things. So during this period, at least during the earlier part of this period, Peroz and his son Narseh, under Chinese control, are at least ruling. How much they actually are campaigning against the Caliphate, we don't really know. And yes, they are buried in China.
And so in this case, China was an ally of the Iranian Empire. And I'm trying to determine how much of this is actually writing that comes afterwards, perhaps by Persians that remained in Iran. Sort of, they were talking about how the Chinese Empire comes and holds the hand of the Iran heir to the throne as he's dying. His grave is facing west towards Iran. You know, it makes me think of the Pahlavi heir to the throne now and all of that. Is this something that's built up later for propaganda purposes for Persians? Or
that actually, it's very, very barely mentioned in Iranian and Islamic sources. It's actually mostly Chinese sources.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
There are mentions of this in the Persian and Islamic sources, but they actually have very little knowledge of this. It's actually the Chinese who claim this. It's the sources are mostly Chinese, and well, but they are not that late. There are two chronicles of the Tang Dynasty, the larger and the smaller Tang chronicles, which would, you know, they mention the story actually. Usually, Chinese sources are Chinese histories are a bit later written based on earlier material, but this is how we know it. So actually, the fact that we know this is from Chinese sources, and we really discovered this when about 100 years ago, a lot of these Chinese sources were translated into French, and that's really where we first got this news. In Islamic sources, the only remains we really have of the descendants of Yazgird is either of a very, of course, mythological, absolutely unfounded story that the daughter of Yazgird, the last emperor, so the sister of this Pirus, supposedly, marries the third Shia Imam, Hussein, and is the mother of the fourth Shia Imam Ali.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is completely mythological. Or probably the true story that the daughter of Vahram, the second son of Yazgird, the third, so the younger brother of this Peroz, he gets defeated by the Umayyads. And he actually does marry the Caliph Walid the first, and is the mother of the Caliph Yazid the third. That probably is a real story. She probably really did marry them. But that's really what remains in Islamic sources. The stories of them being in China, being buried towards Iran, being given permission to build a temple, ruling in the name of these are all actually Chinese sources, not Islamic Iran.
Why would the Chinese care about all of this to chronicle all of this? Was this important to them?
Well, the Chinese do want to prove that they have a lot of power in the West. The Chinese, in a sense, you could say China, since the time of Emperor Qin, have been really defining themselves against the Central Asian, what they call barbarians, you know, the Central Asian tribes.
Yeah.
So control of Central Asia for the Chinese was always a sort of a existential issue. So having control as far as that, and particularly since this is the area where Buddhism comes from. And the Chinese really get introduced to Buddhism not through India, but through what is today Afghanistan. So them controlling the center of Buddhism for them is a matter of prestige. So they obviously mention this, plus the fact that they are consummate record keepers. Anyway, the sources are actually Chinese sources.
In preparing for this conversation with you, I was interested in Sasanian warfare, obviously. We discussed it in the last segment. And one of the things that I kept on coming across online and also on social media is women warriors during the Sasanian period. And particularly on social media, much of this is married into the current women-led and women-sustained uprising protests in Iran.
Yeah.
So I made a point to ask you about this. Were women in the military during the Sasanian period?
Not that we have any evidence of, no.
So there's no such a thing of women generals, women warriors, women fighting corps?
Not really that we have anything. We have references to warrior women in, you know, the one that pops into my head mostly right now is the sister of Vahram Chobin, this Sasanian general / rebel who rebels actually against Khosrow II's in the earlier part of his rule. And she's mentioned to be somebody who, you know, rides a horse and fights and things of the sort. And that her shifting her loyalty from her brother to Khosrow II is the reason that her brother loses. You know, this is like,
interesting.
She becomes an ally of Khosrow. You know, these things do exist. We obviously have two Sasanian queens, regnant queens. One of them actually issues coins with her own face on it, with everything like that. So we do have, it's not that women weren't at all considered, but no, we don't have really cores of Sasanian women fighters. We don't really know anyway that much about Sasanian military until the very end, really. There's very little known about who made up the army. But no, we have no really references.
Interesting. My last question is this. Do you think that the people of Iran are leaning more and more to their Persian past, particularly Sasanian past? I've seen it in Europe, people were demonstrating, protesting in the last 2-3 months with the standard, with the flag of the Sasanian Empire. I don't know if you saw any of these.
Oh, that flag, yeah.
That flag, yeah. So do you think there's a shift to that?
I taught this past term at Leiden University a course called The Use of an Abuse of Ancient History in Formation of Modern Iranian Nationalism. What you're asking is a really, really complicated process of modern Iranian nation building, which I think really requires its own, well, course. It took me 13 weeks to kind of scratch the surface of this. I feel like generally during the Pahlavi period, we had a very strong ancientism,
yeah,
interest in the ancients. I feel like Achaemenids were a lot more of interest. And if you read the book by my very good friend and colleague, Talin Grigor, she actually sort of, based on iconography and based on, you know, what's the visual sources for Iran, also makes this case an argument. But Sasanians are inevitable. As I said, I think most of what we recognize as Iranian, which the Pahlavis were then trying to promote, is actually rooted in the Sasanian period. So Sasanians were inevitable. But I actually think that in a sense, you know, who cares? They're all dead. But they actually lost to Achaemenid.
You say that as a historian. I love it.
Yeah, because I'm not a nostalgist. I'm a historian. I'm a scholar. Yeah, yeah. I'm not there in order to wax nostalgically about dead people. The Sasanians really take a backseat to the Achaemenids. Achaemenids are the ones that get promoted. If you see, like in the past 10, 15 years, there's a celebration of the day of Cyrus the Great. The most visible sort of thing that we have, we reference, is Cyrus's cylinder. Yeah. If you go to any Iranian restaurant, you see Achaemenid soldiers with their
spears and javelin, yeah.
Standing there. So it's actually the Achaemenids that are of more interest. But yes, certain things of the Sasanians are inevitable. And particularly since Sasanians, interestingly enough, are somehow associated with the, you know, the exact, the traditional source of Iranian history, which is something like the Shahnameh. They are mentioned in the Shahnameh, while the Achaemenids are not, obviously.
Yeah. Right?
So there is a lot of references to them, but I feel like that if I was going to say that the sort of nostalgia for ancients exists, is actually an Achaemenid nostalgia. And Sasanians and, well, Parthians very much so, are actually neglected in this
thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Azakhani, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much. You debunked many of my beliefs about the Sasanian Empire.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those things.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.